You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. Coming up, we hear from the new DNR secretary appointee here in Wisconsin about his first few weeks on the job and top priorities for the agency. First, a couple weeks back on the show, we looked at a new fusion technology breakthrough using lasers to start a fusion reaction to create energy. It's still a long road to usable fusion energy in our daily lives, but that same kind of laser technology is already useful for astronomers. Our next guest is using the same kind of high-energy laser technology to study the stars and distant planets from inside his own lab. Adam Frank is the Helen F. and Fred H. Gowan Professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Rochester. His latest book is Light of the Stars, Alien Worlds and the Fate of the Earth. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. We had this apparent big breakthrough in fusion. Why are you, as an astronomer, excited about that?
Well, I'm excited about that development as a citizen of the Earth, because it's been a long, long time that we have dreamed of being able to use the same mechanisms that the sun uses to generate energy here on Earth. I mean, literally from the 1950s, people started thinking about it. And there was this joke that fusion was always 20 years away, but that breakthrough was the first time it was done in a lab. It showed that it was possible. And so there's still a long route to building a reactor that you could power a city with, but just showing that it was possible in a lab was a milestone we had to cross.
But then it turns out, if we're trying to get the same energy source as happens in the middle of a sun, that might let people like you study what happens in the middle of the sun. How can you put that into action for your research?
Yeah, so the amazing thing is that these, in order to make fusion work in a lab, you have to, or at least one way of doing it, is by using these huge, factory-sized lasers to squeeze a target down to conditions, temperatures and densities that you get in astronomical environments. And so even on the long road towards the milestone that we reached this year, 20 years ago, we started using these lasers, these giant machines to get to do experiments where we brought targets up to astrophysical conditions to study things like what happens when a star forms, or what happens when two giant clouds of interstellar gas slam into each other. So it turns out that these, since you're already trying to get astrophysical conditions in the lab to make power, you can just make those astrophysical conditions and study them as a way of for the first time actually having direct contact with the stuff in astronomy, as opposed to just looking through a telescope.
Yeah, you wrote a piece in The Atlantic, Adam, and I got the gist that you and fellow astronomers are a little jealous. Chemists can fiddle around with test tubes, and physicists and geologists have their things, and then you mostly only get to look at things from very far away. How exciting is it for you to be able to do some of this stuff in a lab here on Earth?
Yeah, well, so the really interesting thing about astronomy is it's an observational science. So you never get to tweak anything. You just basically, look through the telescope, you capture a few photons, beat them to death so that they give up their secrets. But you never have a chance to say, well, what would happen if that star was a little bit bigger? Or what happens if that gas cloud was a little bit more dense? So being able to actually do experiments where you run the experiment, look at the data, and then go back and change conditions, that was just not in the cards for astronomers. And remember that astronomy is a very old science, right? It goes back, thousands of years. So this is the first time in the entire history of the field that we're able to create kind of macroscopic conditions, enough of the stuff that we can really poke around in it and begin to see sort of how this stuff would behave under different kinds of conditions and answer new questions.
So what are some of the biggest questions? You hinted at a couple of them there that you're hoping we can use this same technology we use for fusion here, again, to gain that understanding. Let's stay with stars for the moment.
Well, okay, so with stars, when stars form, you get a giant gas cloud that collapses on itself. And what's really amazing is you get this material falling down onto the protostar, but you also get these jets, you get these supersonic beams of gas, of plasma, streaming out at 500 kilometers a second. And they're very mysterious objects. Why do they form? What happens when they form? And you can actually create little versions of these, that are like a centimeter across. inside the lab, but they're moving at the right speeds and they have the kinds of physics involved that you actually see in the one that's a light year across. So we can actually keep running these experiments in the lab to understand the physics of these hypersonic magnetized plasma beams.
We're talking to Adam Frank, professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Rochester, looking at the same technology you may have seen headlines about with fusion energy. It's letting us, well, astronomers anyway, do experiments here on Earth to understand what happens in the middle of stars. And Adam, in that piece in The Atlantic, you wrote, there are some planets, these really big super Earth type planets that we keep spotting elsewhere. We can use some of the same technology to know what's going on inside of them.
Yeah. And that's the stuff that really gets me excited right now. So, you know, we, throughout all of human history, we had no idea whether there were any planets out there other than the eight orbiting the star. It could have been that planets were incredibly rare. Turns out they're dime a dozen. There are planets. Every star in the sky has planets orbiting it, which means those are places where you might get life, right? So we're really interested in the conditions in some of these planets that we found. And it turns out the most common kind of planet in the universe is one we don't have in our solar system. It's called a super Earth, and it's a planet that's maybe two or three times the mass of Earth. And that's big enough that we don't really know what the conditions inside a planet like that are. Will they produce plate tectonics? Will they produce magnetic fields? All these things that actually have turned out to be very important for evolution on Earth. So what we can do with these in the laboratory is we can take stuff that we know will be inside a super Earth and squeeze it down to the conditions that are deep, deep, deep in one of these planets and see things like, well, does it flow? You know, is that material going to flow, you know, distort? So that would be the kind of thing that would tell us, oh, yeah, maybe you'll get plate tectonics in that kind of system. Or does it conduct electricity, which will help us tell us, do these super Earths have magnetic fields, which are very important for protecting life? These new experiments we're doing are taking us, they're kind of a new kind of telescope to see inside this entirely new class of planet that we've discovered in the universe.
Yeah, one key ingredient inside planets, I think you mentioned this in that piece, is iron. So like, can you literally say, let's take a chunk of iron and expose it to the kind of temperatures and pressures that we wouldn't have on Earth, but we might have inside this super Earth, and then see what happens?
Yeah, that's exactly what we do. We take a little sample of iron and blast it with these, you know, 60 laser beams or 192 laser beams and squeeze it to the point where we can see whether or not it will stay liquid. Like, when does it melt? Because that's what's really important on the inside of, like, inside the Earth, there's a liquid iron core that rotates. It swirls around as the Earth rotates. And that's what creates the Earth's magnetic field. And it's the Earth it's that field that protects the Earth from the harmful radiation from the sun. So does the same thing happen in a super Earth? And recently, some of my colleagues did an experiment where they blasted that iron and they saw, like, oh, now we can tell how big a super Earth could be before it loses the magnetic field.
Now, I've talked to people who, you know, with the Webb telescope, the astronomers around the world are like lining up to get some time on that. Do you have something similar to that? I know at University of Rochester, that's a big fusion laser research place. Is this a thing where you've got astronomers saying, hey, I've got this project I want to check out. Can you give me some time to blast these lasers?
Yeah, well, so the laser at the University of Rochester, which is called the Omega Laser System at the Laboratory for Laser Energetics, it's actually a kind of public telescope. Like, other scientists can apply, say, hey, I've got this great idea. I want to use it. Can I get some shots on it? Because each shot, every time you turn on that laser, you know, I'm not sure exactly what the price is, but it's pretty expensive to do one shot of that laser. So, the government has provided funds for that. And so we have a continual stream of people coming through, both astronomers and laser physicists, because they have to work together. The astronomers don't know how to use the giant laser, working together, proposing projects to study everything from the inside of planets to, as I've said, looking at how radiation flows through the outer layers of a star. So now it's becoming quite a popular way of asking astronomical questions.
And briefly, I assume there's a lot of computer modeling going on of the things we're talking about inside suns and stars. Are these observations, when we do these blasts, going to make those computer representations better?
Yes, that's exactly one of the things you do with this. So, you know, in astronomy, we've gotten quite used to using, that's actually the kind of work I do. I'm a computational astrophysicist. And so to look at something like a cloud collapsing under its own weight, a giant interstellar cloud, to form a star, what we do is we run these incredibly complicated numerical simulations that sort of animate the process and let us see what happens. But of course, we haven't had any, you know, we can't test them other than, you know, the what we see in the telescope. And so using these experiments, we can actually refine our simulations and make sure the physics is working correctly. So then when we go apply them to something like a giant interstellar cloud, we have much more confidence that the computer is doing the right thing.
Adam, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
That's Adam Frank from the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Rochester. He joined us to talk about how fusion technology is helping us test distant stars and planets in labs here on Earth. Coming up, meet the new Secretary of Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources for a look at top priorities in the new year. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. In the new year, there's also new leadership at Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources. You might have missed it in the last week of 2022. Governor Evers appointed longtime Sheboygan County Commissioner Adam Payne to replace Preston Cole as the DNR's secretary after Cole announced his departure. Payne has not yet been confirmed by the state Senate, but has started the job as secretary designee. I talked to Secretary Payne on Friday. Can you talk, first of all, about your personal connection to Wisconsin's natural resources?
That's a great question. I grew up in Stevens Point along the Wisconsin River, and my dad's a retired wildlife professor, and I can tell you early on, he instilled in us the value and importance of natural resource protection and enhancement. He taught us how to hunt and fish and trap, and I mean, you name it, anything in the outdoors we did. And I've always had such a love and appreciation for our natural resources in Wisconsin, and certainly the people engaged with helping protect and enhance our natural resources. So early on, I felt as though that was instilled in me, and also spent some time on my grandmother's century farm in Sheboygan Falls. And if there's one thing I learned as a young boy, it's that our farmers are conservationists, and they do so much to protect and improve the land and our water. So I just feel as a young boy, it was instilled in me, and I'm really pleased now at age 55 to have this opportunity.
Now, there's a lot of interests involved in natural resources in Wisconsin. You mentioned hunting and fishing. There's farming. You also mentioned large and small scale resource extraction, camping and hiking, the environment. How do you see yourself in this role balancing all those interests that sometimes align and sometimes don't?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I really feel my career, I've had so many wonderful experiences and worked with so many good people to help me develop as a professional, and just the importance of working with stakeholders and reaching out and listening to people and engaging and building consensus. And when I was with the Sheboygan County as county administrator for 24 years, I worked with a county board and many committees, advisory committees, many stakeholders on not only natural resource protection, but, you know, transportation improvements, economic development, housing, law enforcement, I mean, from A to Z. So as I enter this field and this tremendous opportunity to learn more about the Department of Natural Resources, I recognize there's no way you can learn everything. You can't get in the weeds in every single situation, but you need to listen to your staff. We're so blessed to have so many professional scientists and just tremendous, passionate, hardworking, knowledgeable employees. You need to listen to them. You need to learn. And you certainly need to engage all of our stakeholders and listen to them and build consensus. And that's exactly what I've done in the past. And that's what I intend to do as Secretary of the DNR.
One of the biggest issues we've talked about a lot on the show lately is PFAS in various kinds of water, surface, ground, drinking water. And this is, you know, border to border in Wisconsin communities facing this. How do you see yourself tackling that problem?
That's a great question. And you know, I'm in my second week, right? And so obviously there's some orientation and just going through some of the basics to get acclimated. But I've quickly gained an appreciation for what I think is our number one priority right now, and that's water quality. And certainly Governor Evers has made that very clear as well. We absolutely have to invest more to protect and improve and safeguard our water quality in the state of Wisconsin. So as I've drilled into the PFAS situation and what a horrible pollutant this is and how many communities it's impacting and how many individual resident wells it's impacting, we absolutely have to be even more aggressive in being sure that we're making sure people can drink clean water, and that if they have this horrible pollutant come their way, that we have a quick emergency response plan of action to assist people. I recently became a grandparent, and I don't know anybody that wants to drink polluted water, and certainly don't want their kids or grandchildren to drink polluted water. And this is a growing concern in our state, and we have to invest more time and money and effort to be sure that we're protecting our water, improving it, and helping people when they need it.
Talking to Adam Payne, new secretary appointee for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Secretary Payne, that's one issue, the water quality concerns. Again, you're just a couple weeks in, but what are some of the other things you see as priorities that you want to get up to speed on as fast as possible?
Well, again, good question. I mean, I'm trying to get a feel for all six divisions and the very important work they do. Obviously, our air quality is so important. Water quality, again, continues to be the area that I'm most concerned about right now. But there's some other key issues. Obviously, we have a lot of people who enjoy the great outdoors, hunting, fishing, what have you. We have a number of plans in place, whether it's the proposed wolf plan, whether it's proposals on improving parks, whether it's adding more property, stewardship opportunities. There's a lot of opportunity for improvement, and that's how I was raised. I'm, again, going to listen and learn. I'm second weekend, right? But when stakeholders and our staff raise opportunities for improvement to protect and enhance our natural resources, to sustain our natural resources, to make sure that we have a healthy environment and people today and future generations tomorrow can enjoy it, I really enjoy problem solving and being a part of that and leading that process.
A story I guess I assume you've been following as a deer hunter yourself over the years, a chronic wasting disease in the state's deer herd. I remember it emerging as this brand new thing back in the 90s. Now it seems to be endemic in many communities. Have you had thoughts as a hunter, as a local conservationist now in this statewide post on what we can do to try to turn the tide on this?
Yes, I've thought about it a lot over the years, as have my friends and family members. I've been deer hunting since I was 12 and love to bow hunt. I mean, I just love to hunt, period, and spend time in the great outdoors, particularly bow hunting. But CWD is obviously just a terrible disease. And I sure appreciate the Department of Natural Resources efforts, particularly over the last 5-10 years, to try to get a handle on it and raise awareness with hunters and the public that, you know, you need to be sensitive about whether or not you want to consume meat that has CWD. I mean, we obviously don't know if it can transfer to humans, but is that a risk people want to take? So not only do we have to continue to inform and educate, not only do we have to continue to do a lot of research and better understand this, but what management practices are we going to use going forward to control the herd, try to control this disease, and keep people informed? And there again, I'll be relying on our staff and really looking forward in the weeks and months ahead, learning more from them on what plans they have in place and how we can better and more effectively manage this. On a personal note, and I'm sure most of your listeners, particularly, you know, people that deer hunt, it's spreading across the state just as it has in many parts of the nation. And candidly, I'm not so certain how effectively we can change that. I mean, in the past, the DNR was thinking about really knocking down the deer herd big time to try to control it. And of course, that wasn't popular, right? So I'm not so certain if we're going to be able to eradicate CWD through hunting or that type of management. But we certainly need to better understand it. And as I've shared with some of my hunting friends in the past, it'd be nice if we had a field test or something like that for CWD, where you could take that test right in the field and know whether or not that animal has it. Because so many of us have harvested a nice deer. We're looking forward to taking that animal home and sharing it with our family and friends. You go through the process of taking care of that deer in the field. You take it home and you butcher it. And you cut it up and you put it in wrapping paper and all the steps that go with a good hunt. And then you get those CWD test results and you know what, this is an animal that unfortunately, if it tested positive, we shouldn't consume. So a lot to learn in this area.
And finally, you're an appointee of a Democratic governor. It's a Republican-controlled legislature, not always a rosy relationship, to say the least. What would you say to Republicans in the legislature about ways to find common ground and work on solutions?
I appreciate this question because for the last 24 years working as county administrator in Sheboygan County, we didn't worry about who the D's and R's were on the county board. We really worked to problem solve. And we had such an effective team of board members and staff, and we just didn't get into those political dynamics. And when it comes to natural resource protection and enhancement, when it comes to clean water and making sure that we can protect this tremendous resource we have, I don't think that should be partisan. So I really look forward to working with all of our legislators on what we can do to further protect public health, safety, make sure we have clean water going forward, and make sure that areas that are becoming polluted with PFAS or nitrates or whatever it may be, that we are working decisively to try to clean it up or at least help people get clean water so they can continue to raise their family and feel some assurance that what they're drinking is safe.
Secretary Payne, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
That was Adam Payne, Governor Evers' appointee as the new Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. I talked to him about getting settled into the position, how he plans to address topics including water contaminated with PFAS, chronic wasting disease in deer, and the agency's relationships with the Natural Resources Board and state legislature. I spoke to him on Friday. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a lot of people turn to alcohol for relief from stress and anxiety, but for many people, there's a risk that drinking will add to stress and anxiety. A doctor makes the case for cutting back for our mental well-being. Plus, we'll look at expected changes in food share benefits coming up next month. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the Consumer Price Index shows inflation is slowing down, and economists tells us what that means and why we're seeing that decrease in inflation. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Republican leaders of Wisconsin's Assembly and Senate say they're open to the idea of limited medical marijuana here in the state. We'll find out how states around the country handle their programs and what options may be on the table here in Wisconsin. First, inflation appears to be slowing down after the Consumer Price Index showed inflation declining from the 7.1% rate in November to 6.5% in December. That's generally seen as good-ish news for the economy, but the Federal Reserve is still hoping to see inflation drop to 2% or so. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What does inflation look like to you? Have you seen improvements in things that are important to you that you spend money on regularly? What questions do you have about inflation, efforts to deal with it, possible impacts on the rest of the economy? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Kenneth West is the John D. MacArthur Professor of Economics at UW-Madison. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, of course. It's a pleasure.
Let's start with this news, the inflation numbers for December. Some improvement. I don't think anybody ran out and danced in the streets for it. How big a deal is it, though, that we're seeing at least some decline in inflation?
Well, Rob, in fact, we're seeing a kind of persistent decline in inflation. You mentioned that the annual inflation rate over the last 12 months has been 6.5%. That's kind of an average of in the first 6 months of the last year was very high, 8 or 9%. The last 6 months, it's been lower. 3 or 4%, you average those out, you get to the 6.5% that you mentioned. So inflation has really been very relatively moderate for the last six months, 3 to 4%. As you say, the Fed is hoping to get it down to 2%, so they don't consider their job done yet. But the 6.5 is a little misleading.
Yeah, how so? What might be a better way to look at that number?
Well, I think you can split into the trend. As I say, the trend is coming down. The 6.5 is an accurate figure, but what matters is not only the level, but the trend. And as I say, the trend is inflation's falling. A year ago, it was 8 or 9%. The past few months, it's been less than 2%. And in fact, in December, the most recent month that the data are available, inflation actually fell very slightly, minus 0.1%. That doesn't mean it's going to keep falling. There's a lot of month-to-month variation in the numbers. It does mean that's an optimistic sign that we're moving in the right direction from very high inflation, moving down to moderate inflation. And as you say, the Fed is hoping to get us down to low inflation. We're kind of at 3% now, roughly 3 to 4% in the last several months.
Now, I know there were some arguments about exactly what was causing that high inflation, and maybe that's part of the answer to this question. What is leading inflation to come down now?
In terms of the high inflation, there's maybe three things that have been proposed. One of them, of course, is supply chain issues that followed on the pandemic. With everything shut down, it took a long time to get things started. People weren't spending any money, and they were eager to spend it once we were kind of allowed to go out of our houses and go to restaurants and so on. There's a lot of money chasing goods. They're having a hard time arriving where the money was. So one thing is supply chain issues combined with pent-up household demand. The second is the American Rescue Plan, which with hindsight, the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan was perhaps the negative side effect of pushing up inflation. The final thing is the disruptions from the war in Ukraine. Now, in terms of those, the effects of the American Rescue Plan Act have largely died out. Supply chain issues are largely gone. The disruptions from the Ukraine war, it showed up in gas prices, oil prices, that seems to be diminishing. So on all three accounts, the federal spending, the supply chain issues, the disruptions from the Ukraine war, we seem to be in the right direction. And of course, it's not a guarantee. Something horrible could happen in the Ukraine or elsewhere. But right now, we seem to be moving in the right direction.
Now, when we say inflation overall, I think that's covering up a lot of variation. We see the price of eggs still hanging up there, in part because of avian flu. We see some prices settling down, housing costs up. I could go on all day. Where do you see inflation being stubbornly persistent? Where do you see prices coming down that's driving this decline in overall inflation?
Well, prices coming down, one that's very salient to many people is gas prices. I think the last time I bought gas here in Madison, there's going to be some variation, of course, across the state. I think I paid about $3.30 a gallon, something like that, $3.30, $3.40. 6 or 9 months ago, I was paying $4.40, $4.50. I don't remember exactly. So gas prices are coming down. A major contributor to the overall inflation rate was high housing costs, high rents, and those seem to have stabilized. In fact, goods prices, cars also seem to have stabilized. Going in the opposite direction, mortgage rates have gone way up. So that's going to be tough for people trying to buy houses. So on the good side, what seems to have happened is gas prices, maybe car prices. On the bad side, it kind of seems services are now maybe picking up a little.
Talking to Ken West, economist at UW-Madison, looking at the latest news on inflation. As we've heard, trends moving in a downward direction. Good news overall for the economy. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Where do you see inflation affecting your own financial well-being the most? Are you noticing gas prices going down? If you buy diesel, how is that looking for you? What do you see at the grocery store if you're shopping for big ticket items like cars or houses? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Ken, the Federal Reserve has been reacting to inflation for a while. They have one main tool, those interest rates that play into those mortgage rates you just mentioned. They've been doing bigger increases. What is the thinking now with these better inflation numbers about what the Federal Reserve may or may not do in the months to come?
Sure. Let's just review, first of all, what the Fed's thinking is. which is they control a certain overnight rate used just within the banking system. It's a rate that neither you nor I nor any of your listeners would have access to. But all interest rates are connected. And when they raise this intra-bank rate, that kind of raises all interest rates. So 30-year mortgages are up above 6% now. You know, a year ago, before the Fed started hiking, it was 3%. So the Fed's idea is, as they raise the interest rate that they control, that propagates through the economy, raising mortgage rates and other interest rates, and that slows down interest-sensitive spending, where housing is very interest-sensitive. Now you're going to pay for a house is highly sensitive to what your mortgage rate is. Car buying is highly interest-sensitive. One's sensitivity to the car price depends a lot on the interest rate you're paying if you're financing the car. So that's their thinking. They raise an interest rate that they control. It propagates to the economy. Spending slows down. If spending slows down, there's not as much money chasing a given amount of goods, and inflation will slow down. So that's their thinking. Now, the rates we see, like mortgage rates, as I say, are above 6%. I'm going to quote this bank rate that the Fed controls. They raised it from essentially zero to about 4%. Current thinking, including mine, consensus, is they're probably going to keep raising it. Their own prediction is they're going to keep raising it, probably at least another 0.5% over the next 6 months, maybe as much as 1%. If they do that, the rates that we face for mortgages and car loans are also going to go up. So what's going to happen? As you said, the Fed is not quite happy with inflation. They're roughly running 3%. They want it down to 2%. Probably over the coming year, they're going to raise interest rates a bit, but much less dramatically than they've raised it over the past year. Again, it went from 0 to 4. Now we're talking 4 up to 4.5, maybe 4.75%. And again, this is the interest rate that they control, which is not identical to the interest rates that we see in our mortgages and banking.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Hartford. Liz, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I just turned on the radio and heard your guest say that gas prices are going down and prices are stabilizing. I paid $4.99 for a dozen eggs yesterday, and I filled my tank today at $3.24 per gallon. 2 weeks ago, that was $3.09. So I'm not quite sure where your guest is from. But in Hartford, prices are not stabilizing, and gas is not getting cheaper.
Liz, thanks for the call. Now, big picture, gas has gone down over a bunch of months, but Liz just hit on two things that are kind of weird to measure in inflation. Food prices and gas, those tend to be more volatile, and there are different measures of inflation that include or exclude those. Ken, can you talk about that a little?
Sure. For Liz, first of all, thanks for your question. Two comments. First of all, eggs are in a special category, so special that it's been throughout the media about what's happening to eggs. I'm not an expert on this, but as I understand it, there's been some avian flu,
exactly,
which has made the egg prices skyrocket. It's not to say it's good or something we should ignore that egg prices are going up. It's just a statement that there's something special in eggs, which probably doesn't apply to the rest of the economy. In terms of gas prices, I endorse what Rob said. Overall, they've been going down. They kind of fluctuate up and down, but the trend is clear. So Liz, certainly for me, earlier in the year, I was paying, $4.40, $4.50 a gallon. As I said, I think it was about $3.30 the last time I bought it. I understand from you that $3.10 not too long ago. $3.10 is better than $3.30, and we'd like to get it back down to $3.10. But again, to me, the trend is clear. They are broadly, gas prices are broadly coming down. I mentioned gas prices and food prices are so volatile that within the world of people who specialize in terms of thinking about inflation and thinking about monetary policy, there's another inflation rate called core inflation that simply strips out the volatile components, for example, food and gas. And in fact, the Fed is probably looking more at those than at overall inflation, because their view is no matter what they do, the gas prices are going to jump up and down and food prices are going to jump up and down. Whereas what they really affect with their interest rate hikes is things like purchases of cars and houses. And this core inflation measure is running roughly the same as the overall inflation measure. It's been coming down over the last year. It's also at 3 to 4%. For what it's worth, I mentioned that in December, the overall inflation rate had fallen by a tiny amount. In fact, the core inflation rate rose. And the difference between those, Liz and Rob and other listeners, is really gas prices. Gas prices continue to come down. And when you combine gas prices, the overall inflation rate went down, whereas if you strip them out, as is done among economists and people who study inflation and monetary policy, overall inflation went up. So overall, the picture looks good, whether you strip out gas and food or whether you include gas or food.
Liz, thanks for calling in with the local report. I appreciate it. We're talking to Ken West, professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, looking at reports showing a decrease in inflation. Federal Reserve still hoping to get it down more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about inflation slowing down? What do you see driving that? How did inflation affect your life? Are you seeing improvements, or are you in one of those challenging categories looking for a house and looking at the cost of that mortgage right now? Do you have questions about the economics of this, how it all works? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Ken West, professor of economics at UW-Madison, about inflation slowing down, what it means for consumers, the overall economy. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you are a person who buys stuff, what have you seen? Have you seen some improvements in stuff that you spend money on regularly? If you're looking to buy something in particular, house, car, say, what are you seeing if you sell those things? Love to hear your side of the story, too. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ken, we keep mentioning and hearing that the Federal Reserve would like to get inflation back down to 2%. I wanted to ask about that. As a consumer, we might think, I'd like inflation to be 0% so prices don't go up on stuff. It seems like it's generally seen as healthy to have that little bit of inflation year to year. Why is that?
Well, there are two reasons, Rob. The first thing is it's generally considered that the inflation rate, you ready for this? It overstates the inflation rate. Okay. It assumes essentially that you're buying the same things over and over, which is a good way to measure inflation. But in fact, when the price of something goes up, people tend to substitute into other things, which means their overall spending doesn't rise quite as fast as the rate of inflation. So one reason for it is when things are going up by 2%, the typical consumer doesn't really pay 2% more because they kind of stop buying some of the more expensive things. The second reason has to do with, as we talked about, the Fed raises interest rates to slow down the economy, slow down inflation. It lowers interest rates when it wants to stimulate the economy. So it raises interest rates typically when inflation is getting out of hand. It lowers interest rates when it thinks unemployment is too high. Now, it can't lower interest rates below zero. So it's generally considered there's a good idea to keep this 2% inflation rate that keeps normal interest rates above 2% and gives the Fed some room to cut interest rates by a few percent when they want to cut interest rates to stimulate the economy.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Rich is with us in Wanakee. Rich, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Talking to a non-economist here, but I have a question about the Inflation Reduction Act. So I had heard from another source that had some of that spending been more targeted, and I have a feeling that this is the way a lot of large government bills are maybe distributed, but does it matter if there's a large portion of a bill that's targeted, like specific to something versus like just a large bucket of money for something or some things? and I'll take my question or answer off the air. Thank you for your show.
Rich, thanks a lot for calling in. Yeah, the Inflation Reduction Act, like a lot of big federal government spending things, might say, here's some money for states to use as they see fit. Ultimately, Ken, does, I guess, the labeling, the bucketing of that money or not matter when it comes to inflation?
Well, sure. I'm afraid I couldn't be tell you the specifics about what might change in the Inflation Reduction Act to make it different. But the argument for the Inflation Reduction Act in terms of targeting was it was arguing that it was targeting certain investments that would pay off in the future. So the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan agency that rates federal acts, estimated that the Inflation Reduction Act was going to reduce deficits by some $200 billion over the next 10 years. And you ask, how can spending reduce deficits? And the idea was it's going to be investment in new technologies that would pay off in the future. So yes, what it's aimed at matters. That act was intended to be aimed for things that would be good for inflation rather than bad for inflation. And again, good in the sense of it's investments that'll pay off in the future.
Thanks a lot for calling in with that question. Ken, I think the worry all along with, apart from inflation in and of itself, was that with these interest rate rises, the economy would slow down so much we might enter a recession. And so we might have a, you know, good news, inflation's down to 2%, bad news, unemployment's up to whatever, 9%. What are you looking at to see if that recession, that increase in unemployment is going to happen?
Well, that's an excellent point, Rob. That's, in fact, historically, the Fed has never been able to get inflation substantially down without entering a recession. Now, there's always a first time for everything, so let's hope it's the first time right now. But a substantial reduction in inflation has historically in the U.S. always entailed a recession. Now, what's good news in terms of being cautiously optimistic about not entering a recession is despite the interest rate hikes, the labor market is still looking good. The last unemployment rate was 3.5%, and that is a five-decade low. It has not been that low in 50 years. It's very slightly better than some unemployment rates we've had in the previous several years. So that's good. Consistent with that, the government collects data not only on unemployment, but on the flip side of job openings. And there are many more job openings than there are unemployed people. And that it would be highly, highly unusual in a recession. Now, the future is uncertain. Who knows what's going to happen? It could well be that while things look good now, Rob, you get back to me in 3 months and 6 months and say, what the heck? You said we can be cautiously optimistic. And look at that. Unemployment was 3.5%. Now it's 5.5%. That could happen. So I would say we're kind of have a 50-50 chance in terms of avoiding a recession, in terms of my own odds. I would say Wall Street prognosticators are mostly predicting a mild recession. Some think we can avoid it.
And Ken, in just our last minute or so, what are you watching for next to help answer some of these as yet unanswerable questions?
I would continue to look at, in terms for recession, continue to look at the labor market, continue to look at the unemployment rate, continue to look at the level of job openings relative to the unemployed. And on inflation, I think one should focus on this concept of core inflation, where you strip out the food, strip out the eggs and the gas, because that is something that tends to persist and not jump up and down from month to month. You can get a better idea of the trend by looking at core inflation. So core inflation, number one, and unemployment relative to job openings, number two.
Ken, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me on the show.
That's Kenneth West, the John D. MacArthur Professor of Economics at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about inflation slowing down in the most recent numbers, what that could mean for consumers and for the economy as a whole. Coming up after the news, an expert on marijuana laws around the country joins us to look at the different ways states handle medicinal marijuana after Republican leaders say they're open to the idea in a limited fashion here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.